Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to Africa Link this Tuesday, the 8th of August. My name is Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Isaac Mugabe. We are also live on our Facebook page. As usual, it's DW Africa. Feel free to drop your comments there and we will read them whenever we can.
Coming up.
Yes, Kenyans and Tanzanians are marking the 20th anniversary of the Al-Qaeda bombings of the U.S. embassies in their countries that killed more than 250 people.
Basically, just this letter to remember and give ultimate honor to those who died, those who were injured, who survived, and those whose life will never be the same again.
Nigeria's acting president has sacked the head of the state security agency.
Osinbajo is the acting president for Muhammadu Buhari, who is out of the country on holiday. And some of you are sending in your comments, like Nosu says, there's nothing new in Nigerian democracy. That is happening is personal interest, not about the people.
And of course, you can also contribute. Also on the program, former president of Madagascar, Andry Rajoelina, has told DW that he will contest in the upcoming elections to save the country from corruption.
These are some of the stories we've lined up for you. But first, let's listen to the news in brief, making headlines around the world.
My name is Jane Nyinge with DW News. Nigeria's acting president, Yemi Osinbajo, has sacked the head of state security agency. Lawal Musa Daura was dismissed hours after Department of State security agents prevented lawmakers from entering parliament. Osinbajo is acting president for Muhammadu Buhari, who is out of the country on holiday. A German court has convicted a woman and her boyfriend for offering her child for sex on the so-called darknet. The two who pleaded guilty also admitted repeatedly raping the boy, who was 9 when the trial began late last year. The couple sold the boy to pedophiles on the darknet, an area of the internet that can only be visited with special software. U.S. President Donald Trump has warned countries and companies against doing business with Iran, saying that doing so would remove any chance of trading with the United States. This comes after Trump reimposed sanctions that were in effect before the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Federica Mogherini, said Iran had upheld its commitment under the deal to limit its nuclear program.
We are doing our best to keep Iran in the deal, to keep Iran benefiting from the economic benefits that the agreement brings to the people of Iran, because we believe that this is the security interests of not only our region, but also of the world. If there is one piece of international agreements on nuclear non-proliferation that is delivering, it has to be maintained.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. Zimbabwe's main opposition party says it will tomorrow on Wednesday challenge in court official results showing that President Emmerson Mnangagwa won the country's July 30th elections. Columbus Mavunga with more from Harare.
Douglas Munzora, the Secretary General of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance, is hopeful that his party's challenge will reverse the victory of ruling ZANU-PF party presidential candidate.
In all indications, the application will be successful. In Harare, President Mnangagwa's votes were exaggerated by 130,000. So we have been able to see the discrepancies in the figures.
After official results were announced showing that Mnangagwa had won 50.8%, opposition leader Chamisa said it was actually him who had 56%, thus throwing Zimbabwe's polls into the disputed matrix again.
Columbus Mavunga in Zimbabwe. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara has granted amnesty to former First Lady Simone Gbagbo in what he says is a move to foster reconciliation. President Ouattara granted amnesty to 800 political prisoners prosecuted for crimes connected to the 2010 post-election violence. Kenyans and Tanzanians have marked the 20th anniversary of the Al-Qaeda bombings of the U.S. embassies in their countries that killed more than 250 people. The explosions were the first major Al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. targets. For more news and information, please visit our Facebook page, DW Africa, or our website, dw.com. My name is Jane Nyinge.
And You are listening to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
With me, Zipporah Nyambura. And of course, a warm welcome to our listeners on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Priest Musogong there giving us a thumbs up, and Obina Oba talking about Nigeria. Thank you very much for keeping company.
Now, Kenyans and Tanzanians marked the 20th anniversary of the Al-Qaeda bombings of the U.S. embassies in their countries that killed more than 250 people, including 12 Americans. The explosions on August 7th, 1998, were the first major Al-Qaeda attack on U.S. targets. Nearly 5,000 people were injured.
Accompanied by a choir, mourners lit candles to remember the victims in Nairobi's August 7th Memorial Park. From Nairobi, Andrew Asike sent us these reports.
Samson Odwor Ahono, Nathan Aliganga, Elizabeth Anyango.
It was a somber mood as the names of the victims were read out, one by one. Relatives, friends, and families couldn't hold back tears as they remembered that fateful day 20 years ago. It was one of the darkest chapters in Kenyan history that ever happened. Mary Kinyanjui is one of the survivors who attended the event. She told me she had lost hope in life because of what happened to her, especially in the days that followed the attacks. Life was not easy.
I was told they don't think I'd live beyond 3 months because of the toxins I'd inhaled in the body. They said there was nothing they could do about it. So initially, I expected to die, and it was not easy for me because I kept walking day after day, not knowing what would happen. I'd lose balance. It was difficult because I wouldn't do things alone. Somebody had to be around me all the time. And it was frustrating.
Most of the survivors were maimed forever, which has affected their livelihood, but have learned to live positively. One of them is Douglas Idialo, who lost an eye that day. He tells me what the day means to him.
Basically, just this letter to remember and give ultimate honor to those who died, those who were injured, who survived, and those whose life will never be the same again. And just being here at the Memorial Park, we look at this as a sanctuary of peace, a sanctuary of love, a sanctuary of unity, and just congregating with other orphaned or orphaned children and survivors and families, you know, it brings back those memories. But 20 years on, we feel we are victims. We are not just victims, but people who have become victors in all our spheres of life.
U.S. Ambassador to Kenya, Robert Godek, for his part hailed survivors for their resilience in the wake of the bomb attacks that left the entire world shocked.
We say clearly and loudly that although we have suffered, we are not beat. We will never let those who traffic in death and destruction defeat us.
That report was compiled by Andrew Wasike.
Now, the commemoration of the 20th anniversary of the victims of the U.S. embassy bombing comes at a time when American President Donald Trump has invited his Kenyan counterpart Uhuru Kenyatta in Washington for a meeting to broaden strategic partnerships based on shared democratic values. And many of you have been commenting on this story on our Facebook page, W Africa. Zippy, please.
And of course, someone like Hans Olami says he doesn't think that the Trump administration is competing with the Chinese as far as moving into Africa is concerned. And he says, in fact, inviting Kenyatta has more to do with Kenya than the other 53 African countries.
And Maurice Ocheng says, Trump and Uhuru meeting doesn't mean our relationship is getting better. For a long time now, African leaders meeting with any Western leader, we achieve nothing meaningful from these meetings. Anyway, away from that, in not a related development, but only about Trump, Donald Trump has imposed sanctions again on Iran, warning any country that does business with them risks isolation from the U.S. The sanctions target Iran's automotive sector as well as its trade in gold and excludes them from purchasing U.S. dollars and precious metals.
In his tweet, Trump warned more sanctions are on the way, targeting Iran's energy sector. The U.S. hopes the sanctions will force Iran back to the negotiation table on their nuclear deal. More in this report compiled by Tabia Gopelt.
Effects of Trump's early morning tweet hailing the sanctions as most biting ever imposed has already drawn lots of reactions. European governments are infuriated by his strategy, which leaves their businesses in Iran faced with the threat of US legal penalties. The European Union's diplomatic chief, Federica Mogherini, said the bloc deeply regrets the US move. Iran's currency has lost around half its value since Trump announced the US would withdraw from the nuclear pact in May. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani slammed the sanctions, saying there was a deeper motive behind it.
In my opinion, what Americans are seeking in their psychological warfare is to make Iranian people hesitant about their country and take advantage of it for their Congress elections in the coming month.
Iranians have also voiced their concern over President Trump's action.
Sanctions have definitely had an impact, whether it's on currency exchange rate or price of gold. It resulted in loss of many jobs. Many factories dismissed young workers and they became unemployed. Our government officials should follow track of current events and do a good economic planning so that we could resist sanctions.
If it continues like this, naturally we will not have a good life in the future. It's better if we have some reforms and some issues are resolved. I hope the government thinks about the people.
Experts say some of the sanctions are unlikely to cause immediate effect on the economic, but the second ones expected in November, targeting Iran's vital oil sector, could be far more damaging, even if several key customers such as China, India and Turkey have refused to significantly cut their purchases.
Eunice Wanjiru with that report by Tabia Gopelt. And at this time, we'd like to recognize our listeners, Prince Mosungong and Ogene Otega. Ahmed Mohammed, we can see you there, and Ibn King Khalifa. Many thanks for the debate that you're holding there on our page. Moving to Madagascar, where former President André Rajoelina has been telling DW that he's going to stage a major comeback for the presidency to save the country from degenerating into a den of the corrupt and improve security in general.
Rajoelina was the first to register his candidacy for the first round of the presidential elections, scheduled for November 7th. In this short interview with DW's Eric Topona from the French service, André Rajoelina starts by outlining his plans.
Generalized corruption, rampant inflation, not to mention security issues in the whole of Madagascar. In view of all this, it is my duty to contribute to a solution for the country's development.
Une solution de développement du pays.
On va parler de l'actualité politique, notamment République démocratique du Congo.
Let me ask you about the Democratic Republic of Congo. The Congolese are set to elect a new president on December 23rd, but we still don't know whether President Kabila will be a candidate. What is your point of view?
Quel est votre point de vue là-dessus?
J'ai toujours en fait lancé un appel, comme quoi.
See, the most important thing when you are head of state is to think of coming generations and the population. When people cry out in pain, you have to act and listen to them. It is important for every country to have democratic alternation to ensure its development. A statesman thinks of coming generations. A politician thinks of coming elections. That is why I thought about coming generations first to prepare my comeback.
Il faut être à l'écoute de la population.
Opposition leader Moïse Katumbi has been unable to go home to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Does this situation shock you?
C'est une situation choquante pour vous?
It is above all a form of dictatorship. You cannot keep a citizen from returning to his country.
De rentrer chez lui.
That was Andrea Rajoelina, the former head of state for Madagascar, speaking to our colleague Eric Topona. Now, Eric is currently in Madagascar trying to follow up, you know, events prior to the elections that are scheduled in November 7th, 2018. And of course, Africa Link will be update to bring you whenever these stories we can, especially when it's about elections. Now, Zippy, some heads of state leave office, but of course they choose to come back.
Of course, we have had many more who decide like things are not working out, and no matter the age, they come and rescue. I think depending on the age, It's open democracy.
To them, it doesn't matter age, you know. I think it's good for them whenever they come back when they have so many grays, you know.
But they say democracy. Young. But Isaac, that is what democracy entails. Come back and do it. Thank you very much for the comments.
Welcome back to the program. My name is Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Zipporah Nyamura. And of course, a warm welcome to you listening to us on our Facebook page, DW Africa. We cannot mention all your names, but you can drop us your comments and share this audio. We have a lot lined up for you. Coming up in the next 15 minutes, Ghana is the second largest cocoa exporter in the world, but many farmers don't benefit much from their produce. And now one man is hoping to change all that.
People identify, everyone out there identifies Ghana with cocoa, chocolate, and that kind of stuff. But the interesting dynamic is that the very cocoa farmers are also some of the very poorest people in this country. And I was compelled to come back to Ghana and go back to my community to effect some change.
And interestingly, Zippy, I was speaking to our colleague Eddie Maker Jr. and he told me in Ghana, at least at the moment, they eat their own chocolate, or people prefer to eat their own chocolate. Perhaps things get better.
That is a good start, and actually it tastes very good.
Anyway, also lined up, we'll also hear how the Somali community in the United Kingdom is using food not only just to connect with their roots, but also to bring people together and change perceptions.
For sure, we'll have that and much more. But before that, we head to Cameroon. It is now official. There will be 9 candidates vying for the presidential post in the general election slated for the 7th of October. 18 candidates were today ruled out for irregularities and failure to pay the $55,000 deposit. 86-year-old Paul Biya will be the longest-serving African leader seeking to extend his mandate after 36 years in power.
And this time he will, however, face stiff competition from opposition's main candidate Joshua Osei from the Social Democratic Front, SDF. The election will be taking place against a background of uncertainties in the crisis-prone English-speaking regions of the country and amid accusations that Biya's ruling party is planning to rig the election. Mokinzeka has more on that report that starts with the voice of an 8-year-old Kum Vitalis who is sad about what his family is currently going through.
Nothing is moving. They don't pay my father. And you know the money for school fees or food stamps. That's why they brought me to safety. That one guys.
This is the voice of 8-year-old Kum Vitalis, whose family just fled war in the English-speaking region of Cameroon. The United Nations says he, like other 200,000 people, have left their homes to safer regions or bushes. In fact, reports indicate that 40,000 others have crossed to Nigeria due to escalating violence as armed groups maintain elections will not take place in the English-speaking regions. Like many people here, Ngum Julius, a teacher in the region, says priority should be first resolving the crisis.
All businesses are shut down. All government services are shut down except the military. Many people have gone away from their communities. Too many, many, many people are dying. We need to sit on the same table like Cameroonians and talk it out and find a solution.
Here at Bonamusadi, a student residential area in Yaoundé, university students argue that they should be discussing football instead of elections that will never be effective. Tata Hans is one of them.
I'm a Cameroonian. It's normal to vote. I have to vote. I'm facing so many difficulties because very soon I'll start voting. I don't have any voter's card. I don't know what to do.
However, supporters of President Biya see it differently. Jacques Famendongo says election should go on as planned.
Nous savons que le rêve fou, à savoir éviter l'organisation.
We know that their mad dream is to stop the organization of presidential elections in those two regions. But that mad dream will never come to fruition because the population of the Northwest and the Southwest regions is determined to express their total support to the head of state.
The opposition is already warning the election is a fraud. Denis Nkemlemo, Communication Secretary of main opposition party SDF, says the elections management body has created polling stations in military camps contrary to the electoral law.
We are not supposed to have voting stations inside the presidency. Military camps are out of the question as far as polling stations are concerned. The SDF will not tolerate the lack of respect of the electoral law.
Should Biya win, he will rule the Central African state up to 2025 when the next presidential election will take place.
Moki Kinzeka with that report. And you, dear listener, have been giving us your feedback. Eno Ivo says Paul Biya has already won as usual. When it comes to being ready for a new leader, Le Republique du Cameroun is not ready.
And Wanumata Laba says, now, isn't it very shocking that even people passing for university professors who are in Paul Biya's party think he is the only one who can rule the country even at an advanced age of 86 years? This is not ordinary. Indeed, Zipporah, is not ordinary because, I mean, we asked them, what do you think? Is Cameroon ready for a new leader?
Yeah, and I think after 5 years, he will be 93, so that...
Yeah, he should be very young anyway.
Yeah, and I have to read one last one here from Zawala Simon, who says, 28 candidates tabled their candidature, but only 9 have been said to qualify for the polls. Biya will win. He runs the electoral system.
And one more here from George Mbaku thought maybe if they had formed a coalition, they could stand chances of ejecting Paul Biya out of power. We still have much more to come. Don't go away. Stay with us.
Africa on the move.
Now, financing quality education for many underprivileged children in Africa remains a challenge, not only for governments, but also parents. In most cases, affordable quality education and in some instances, quality healthcare has shattered the dreams of many.
In Ghana, a young man who comes from a deprived community and grew up in poverty is trying to change the narrative with an initiative that is solely based on utilizing the growing of cocoa into a financial module. Isaac Kalechi in Ghana has the rest of the story.
This is Takwa Breman Village in western Ghana. Like many deprived communities in the countryside, roads are bumpy and development lacking. On a sunny day, local farmers here are often seen busy working on their cocoa farms. In this village, the farmers work as a team with hopes of raising enough money to educate their children and pay for their affordable health care. Shadrach Owusu Frimpong is the brain behind this scheme.
I come from Takwa Breman, which is about 8 hours out from here, from Accra. I went to the University of Pennsylvania after graduating from Opoku Arts School. And when I went to Penn, I was fortunate enough to graduate with a President's Engagement Prize, which was $150,000. And as someone who grew up in abject poverty, didn't see electricity perhaps for the first decade of my life, and grew up without running water and electricity in a place as far that remote, I felt an obligation and I was compelled to come back to Ghana and go back to my community to effect some change.
Upon his return to Ghana, Frimpong set up the Cocoa 360 organization that promotes healthcare and education for all, especially young girls. Frimpong's father himself is cocoa farmer, while his mother is charcoal seller. With their meager earnings, Frimpong would not have been able to finance his studies in the U.S., and this is what inspired his Cocoa 360 initiative.
People identify, everyone out there identifies Ghana with cocoa, chocolate, and that kind of stuff. But the interesting dynamic is that the very cocoa farmers are also some of the very poorest people in this country. So we went back, essentially, and with a seed funding from Penn, we decided as a community to start something really new. The community gave 50 acres of land. We used 10 acres of that land to set up a tuition-free all-girls school and a community hospital. And then we used the remaining 40 acres to set up a cocoa plantation.
Frimpong has had the support of family along this path, and his brother Emmanuel Owusu is proud of the support they rendered to him.
Most of us actually supported him because we knew the outcome, because we knew the impact that it will have on the villages, because we knew the impact that it will have on the community as a whole. And the support has not actually stopped. I'm still supporting him until we get to where we want to get to. We will get there.
Frimpong's idea started small, but largely it could be the solution to boosting the agricultural sector that is the backbone of Ghana's economy.
That was Isaac Kalech with that report. And of course, Isaac, it's always encouraging to see young people who are giving back to the community, like Frimpong in this case.
Yes, impressively, you know, girls are going back to school. And of course, there is an exchange of some sort getting affordable health care, which still eludes so many communities in Africa. And this young man, having got his education in the U.S., University of Pennsylvania, he decides to go back and make a difference in his life. And impressively, also Ghana is making good use of its cocoa, you know, by making its own chocolate. Tell us what you think about whether it's always a good move for Africa to process its products without exporting them to have the finished product. We still have much more to come after this.
Focus Europe.
Now, Isaac, I have a question. To what extent does food determine your identity and help you reconnect with your roots?
Big time, big time.
Yeah, and of course, that is also the case for Fozia Ismail, a British Somali woman living in Bristol. It is one of the utmost important thing.
Emma Wallace went to Fozia Super Club, Arawelo Eats, to find out how food has been a connecting thread for a woman who failed Somali even though she was born in Kuwait and grew up in the UK. The Super Club was held on the occasion of Somaliland's Independence Day, which is celebrated on the 18th May each year.
Welcome to Arawelo Eats, and today is Somaliland Independence Day. Yay! Yay! So we've had 27 years of freedom!
The name Arawelo Eats comes from stories of an ancient Somali queen who was known for female empowerment. In some stories, she's portrayed as having castrated men, but for Foz, it's the fact that she forged her own path which is important, a bit like Foz's own mother and Foz herself.
My mum is an amazing cook, but she's illiterate. She grew up as a nomad on the Ethiopia-Somaliland border. When she left Somaliland and she went to Kuwait, I think she enjoyed having the access to, the level of access to different foods. She was married off to my dad, who came from the city, and she didn't have a chance of education in that way. But I felt when we moved, she really gave us, she taught us a lot through food.
And now Foz is teaching her guests through food.
I haven't actually tried it yet.
I'm waiting to hear about it. It's exciting.
So this is, dawa means medicine in Somali and Swahili. And it's...
She introduces each dish to the 14 people who have arrived and are congregating in the kitchen as preparations go on in the background.
Every time I do this, I don't know whether it's rocket fuel or not. It's really... There's a lot of vodka in here, basically. But you can't taste it.
Foz's mother had 10 children, including Foz, and having had a difficult relationship with Foz's father, she moved to the UK alone with her children to start a new life in 1985.
So my family's big, there are 5 brothers, 4 sisters, but then on top of that, visitors that come through during Ramadan, and you're just feeding so many people. So, like, bags of onions that you'd just be cutting through again and again and again, and you'd have a job, and then sambusa, you'd be making the samosa, or we call it sambusa. That's the time she was probably most relaxed. That's the time that I felt connected, really.
Foz studied social anthropology at Cambridge University. She says she enjoyed her time there, but also sometimes found it difficult as a Somali woman who grew up on a council estate in London in amongst a majority of privileged, rich, white people.
I liked the challenge of being there, but I also felt like it is so, so removed from reality, because you'd have all these super rich white kids who were completely thoughtless about the way they travelled around the world, just in a completely entitled way. But I enjoyed, you know, studying, and it's given me a real interest in reading. I like that I can use that to analyse the food world.
Somali food and Somali identity also bear the marks of trade, colonisation and spheres of influence. Engaging with her blackness and her African roots is where she and many other young Somalis are now headed.
So I've always identified as black British Somali, but there's lots of issues of internalised racism where some Somali people don't want to be associated with Africa and want to be associated with Arab and, you know, Arabic culture more than the Somali culture.
This exploration of her Somali indigenous culture comes neatly back to the idea of hospitality in the supper club, inviting people into your home and cooking for them. At this supper club, we guests are all white and middle class, and we've paid to come and try something new. But the feeling of hospitality and exchange runs strongly through the whole evening, which is what Foz is trying to do, not just at her supper club, but on the food scene itself.
Emma Walters' report ends the show. I'm Isaac Mugabe.
And I'm Zipporah Nyambura.